I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. The Civil War was the bloodiest conflict in American history, claiming an estimated 620,000 lives. That's a number that's roughly the population of present-day Vermont. And while Vermont can lay claim to being the first U.S. state to ban slavery in its Constitution of 1777, some Vermonters did own slaves, and many were reluctant to give them up even after the practice of slavery in New England started to dwindle in the early 1800s. Slavery is an uncomfortable topic, and the bitter legacy it left behind is still a matter of conflict and tension in this country more than 150 years after the end of the Civil War. But our guest today says it's an important topic to discuss, and he's written a book about a region of the country not often linked to discussions about owning other human beings as property, and that region is New England. Jared Ross Hardesty is the author of Black Lives, Native Lands, White Worlds, A History of Slavery in New England. He joins us today on the line from Washington State, where he's an associate professor of history at Western Washington University. Professor Hardesty, thank you so much for joining us today on Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, anchor us a bit in history here. When we're talking about slavery in northern states like New England, what time period are we talking about chiefly? Where did most of these men and women enslaved in New England come from?
So you're talking mostly in New England, at least. Slavery is a 17th and 18th century phenomenon, and it existed from the moment, pretty much the moment that English settlers arrived in the region, so the 1620s and 30s, up through the early 19th century, you have a kind of the existence of slavery. Although there are still enslaved people in the region up through the end of the Civil War. And so their own, slavery is actually only ended in places like Connecticut, for example, in 1865 with the 13th Amendment. Hmm. But it's largely confined to the 17th and 18th century. That's where you really see slavery as an institution.
And where were many of these people brought from as they came here to New England?
This is kind of an interesting, many of them are from Africa, and it's going to change over time, the enslaved people. In the 17th century, they're mostly from what's today kind of West Central Africa, so what's today Angola, the Kingdom of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, what was then known as the Kingdom of the Congo. But then it begins to change. By the early 18th century, many of the enslaved people in the region come from the Senegambian region of West Africa, which is kind of to the north, just south of the Sahara Desert. And those folks, so Phyllis Wheatley, for example, is from Senegambia. But the other interesting thing for enslaved people of African descent in New England is that how many of them were actually born in the Americas and then brought to New England. So many were born, for example, in the Caribbean, Barbados, Antigua, Suriname, which is a Dutch colony in South America, and brought here. But you also have, outside of the Puritans enslaving the local indigenous population in the 17th century, there's also a fairly robust trade in enslaved people from the enslaved Indians from the Carolinas being sold to New England in the early 18th century.
Professor, you mentioned just now, you said Puritans, who were having a lot of these slaves. And it would seem to me that on the face of it, at least, that would go very much against their religious teachings, upbringings, and what's said in the Bible. Or is that not the case?
That is not the case. Actually, you know, depending on how you read the Bible, it can be radically anti-slavery. So the book of Exodus, for example, is a slave rebellion.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you read Leviticus, for example, there's all sorts of laws governing the treatment of enslaved people. Or when you look to the New Testament, there's a fairly strong endorsement of slavery. When Paul's on the road to Damascus, he encounters a runaway slave named Onesimus. And he essentially tells Onesimus to go back to his master, that we have to obey our master, both godly and earthly. And so he should return to slavery. So there are, in the Bible, there is, it condones slavery in a lot of ways. And the other thing we have to remember about the Puritans is that they certainly have a particular religious outlook, but they were also early modern Englishmen and women. And they have certain ideas and certain cultural baggage they bring with them to the Americas. And one of those they bring when they settle the region are ideas about colonization, how colonies are supposed to function, how you make colonies successful. They have many models for, you know, colonization by the time New England settled in the 1620s and 30s, looking to Roanoke, which failed, or to Jamestown, which succeeded. And one of the ideas they bring with them, observing the Spanish colonies in Latin America, is that one way to make a colony successful is to ensure you have a constant supply of labor and that enslaved Africans can actually provide that labor. So they come to New England with these ideas that one way for a colony to be successful is to enslave Africans.
That's amazing. So that's very much the same rationale, I would think, that drove the southern states to maintain their economies.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're all English people at the end of the day. And, you know, this comes out of the 16th century when English people go abroad for the first time. And they visit the Spanish colonies in Latin America, the Portuguese colony of Brazil. And they encounter enslaved Africans, and they begin to associate both, you know, if you need labor, you can turn to enslaved Africans, but also with associating blackness, Africanness with slavery.
Professor Hardesty, when we're talking about Vermont, you know, I mentioned at the top here that this was the first state in the nation to officially abolish slavery in its constitution, 1777. At the same time, though, Vermont was not immune to having a legacy of slavery. What can you tell us about who owned slaves in Vermont, and how prevalent was this practice compared with perhaps other New England states?
So I think when I think about Vermont and its relationship to slavery, I think of it as kind of encapsulating the history of slavery in New England during the Revolutionary era, because Vermont's this kind of revolutionary experiment, you know, founded 1777 as an independent republic. And there was a very strong tradition, as you mentioned, of anti-slavery, of, you know, they ban it in the Constitution. Yet when you look at legislation from the Vermont legislature in the 1780s and in the 1790s after statehood, there's a number of laws that are passed that are banning slave trading, that are banning the selling of enslaved people out of Vermont. And what this suggests is that this practice is still going on. It still existed. As we know, in the 1777 Constitution, it only banned adult slavery, not that of children. So there's enslaved people still in Vermont. If you look at the 1810 census, you'll see there's actually people, slaves are enumerated in the census. They're calculating the 1810 census. And, you know, individuals, and so there were slaveholders in Vermont even after the Constitution. So on the one hand, that's a fairly common thing across the region. It's very ambiguous into slavery. There's laws against it, but it does seem to still be in practice. But one of the things that we have to remember about Vermont is that it is settled by, you know, largely smaller farmers from other parts of New England. It's kind of main source of settlers. And so slaveholding would not have been as robust as, say, a place like Boston, where there's large-scale slaveholding across, you know, 25% of families in Boston owned enslaved people.
25%? Wow, that's a pretty big number.
It's a sizable number, right? About 12 to 15% of Boston's population was enslaved in the middle decades of the 18th century, and even more in Newport, Rhode Island. And so it wouldn't have been that density of slaveholding that you see in the major urban areas, or even in really productive rural areas. So the Connecticut River Valley is home to many enslaved people, and same with the Narragansett country in Rhode Island. So you're looking at kind of small kind of household slavery, farm families that own one or two slaves to kind of supplement the family labor.
We have Kevin on the line with us from Charlotte. Hi, Kevin. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is somewhat unrelated, but it also is related. I just saw CBS News did a wonderful program on the treatment of slavery in history classes and history textbooks. And Vermont was one of several states where it's not even being taught in the books. And I don't know if he's obviously done a lot of study of the history of slavery, but I was kind of shocked by that.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for the call. What about that, Professor Hardesty? Do we know anything about the various regions around New England and how they taught about this history, or in this case, perhaps, as Kevin was saying, maybe did not?
I mean, when I think about the reaction to this book, I've given a number of talks in New England and actually out here on the West Coast where I am. that is the number one response I get is, I've never heard this story before. And it's not just, you know, and a lot of times it is older people, you know, middle-aged people who come up, oh, I never learned this in school. But sometimes it's younger people as well, where if slavery is taught at all at the secondary level, it's taught as largely a Southern phenomenon. It's, you know, it's the peculiar institution of the South. It's associated with the large-scale cotton plantations and the kind of lead-up to the Civil War. That's how people learn about slavery. They don't learn about its kind of deeper history, that deeper history, which, of course, goes clear back to the moment that English settlers arrived, or, well, Spanish settlers arrived, actually, in North America in the 16th century, and that one that is everywhere. It's in every place that became the United States. Slavery existed in one way or the other. And so, you know, that's... thinking about the kind of reaction to the book and the way in which, you know, this information is disseminated, it's been kind of an interesting reaction to the book. Because sometimes people are shocked. They don't realize, you know, just how prevalent slaveholding was. You know, as you grew a bit surprised by the 25% in Boston.
Right.
Those sorts of, it's really shocking. And in some cases, upsetting, you know, especially for younger people who, if they feel kind of misled when they learn about this history, especially in the region. I have some friends that teach at, you know, universities across New England, and they, when they teach this history, younger people, there's a kind of a shock, and they feel like they've been misled and kind of let down.
Do people bristle at all a little bit? You know, feel almost like, you know, defensive.
Sometimes in the abstract, generally not. So, you know, my book is a picture of the whole region. And while I do use kind of specific examples, oftentimes of individual people, I don't talk about particular localities, you know, and local histories and or things like that. So in the abstract, the reaction has actually been very positive to the book, where people are excited to learn this history. There seems to be a thirst for this knowledge. On the other hand, I've heard, you know, talking to people who are doing this work on the ground in local communities, especially looking around kind of locally revered figures, that there can be some pushback, there can be some denial, some unwillingness to engage the material.
We have Todd on the line with us from Shrewsbury. Todd, thanks for the call. You're on Vermont Edition.
Yes, good afternoon. Many thanks to the professor to bringing some of these issues to light. It's interesting to me because I've actually just been reading a bit lately regarding the Pequot Wars, which I'm sure the professor is familiar with.
He's written about that in the book, yes.
Yes, yes. It's kind of a dark chapter very early on in our history, as the professor mentioned. I think it was in 1638 that some of the first Native Americans were enslaved by people who claimed to be Christian. And that's actually one of the reasons that I was calling, is that I think the professor may have accidentally missed the forest for the trees in one area. When he got into biblical justifications for slavery, many people do this. They overlook something absolutely central that Christ taught. In fact, it goes all the way back to something Moses taught back roughly 1800 B.C. Christ was addressed by someone who asked, what is the greatest commandment in the law? And Christ said, you shall love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. He says, this is the great and foremost commandment. But he said, the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That is really the epitome of the biblical law. So in other words, you cannot enslave someone and treat them as you would wish to be treated. It's just totally inconsistent. So that really trumps all of the minutiae that people try to find in the Bible to support notions like slavery. So, you know, I say this with respect.
Sure.
But I think that this is a large area that is often overlooked.
Well, Todd, thank you very much for that call. Professor Hardesty, we're about to go to a break, but I'd like you to react just briefly to what Todd was saying there about that overall message in the Bible that perhaps gets missed.
I mean, I think there's a certain truth to it, but that's not how the Puritans viewed it. I mean, when the Puritans read the Bible, they extracted the messages that they wanted to take from it, and one of those messages that slavery's totally fine, and you know, through their kind of critical reading of the Bible, and in fact, you know, one of the interesting things about the history of, especially of abolitionism, that abolitionism is one of the things that leads to modern day biblical criticism that kind of uncovers those universal truths that Todd talks about because of the way in which people who held slaves used the Bible to justify it. It created a whole kind of new scholarly category to need to analyze the Bible and find its core kind of anti-slavery message.
We've been speaking today, and we are still speaking this hour, with Jared Ross Hardesty. He is the author of Black Lives, Native Lands, White Worlds, A History of Slavery in New England. He'll still be on the line with us, but we're going to be joined by another guest right now. And a lot of people these days are taking advantage of online and other tools that allow them to research their ancestry. We're speaking today with a woman who discovered something amazing about her family tree over a decade ago. Rhonda Brace had no idea that she is a descendant of a slave who was brought to New England, fought in the Revolutionary War, and eventually lived out the rest of his life in Vermont. Rhonda Brace works in Connecticut and joins us now from the studios of Connecticut Public Radio. Rhonda, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So it turns out that you're related to a man named Jeffrey Brace. How did you come to learn about your relationship to him?
It was back in 2004 or 5. A colleague of one of my uncles provided him with a newspaper article from the Rutland Herald that spoke of the finding of a book in the Special Collections Library at the University of Vermont and how a woman named Carrie Winters, she was a professor at the time, researched the book. And it was a book that was penned by Jeffrey Brace called The Blind African Slave.
And was he actually blind, or was that a metaphor in the title there?
No. He was actually blind at the time he had it penned. He had a gentleman named Benjamin Prentice pen the memoir for him.
Wow.
Just so that he could leave a legacy behind that, you know, those who held people as slaves would maybe come to their consciousness to not do it any longer.
Well, what was your initial reaction when you learned that you were related to this man?
I found it profound because for me, I always knew that my family lineage traced back to St. Albans on my father's side of the family, on his paternal side of the family. And with records and information that we had at home of my grandfather's grandfather, and then reading the article, there were certain similarities in the article that pointed or piqued my interest because they talked about Jeffrey Brace and they talked about St. Albans. And having known that my family tree went back to St. Albans and having documents for that, because my grandfather's grandfather was Jeffrey. His name was Jeffrey Brace. And so the Jeffrey name had come through my family for generations. And to be able to kind of connect myself back to Africa, to go back further than Vermont, was really a profound finding for me. So I found it, you know, you're always giving the fact that, you know, you're Black or you're African-American, but I could never really connect myself to Africa. For me, it provided an opportunity for me to connect myself back to Africa.
It really is an amazing story. And much of what he wrote about, too, was the fact that he fought in the Revolutionary War. What did you learn about his service?
Well, the idea for me, as far as the Revolutionary War, you know, you talked earlier about being something that we learn about in school about Blacks being enslaved, even so Blacks in the Revolutionary War. And I can remember being a student in high school. History is not my favorite subject. But for me, it was not my favorite subject, number one, because I could connect myself to the war stories. And so learning about Jeffrey Brace's enlistment in the Revolutionary War piqued my interest. But not only that, it made me proud that one reason why he enlisted is because he wanted to be free. And in order to be free, he enlisted into the American Revolutionary War. But not only did he enlist one time, he was in and then he got out, but then he re-enlisted because at first he was promised his manumission, but it didn't receive it. So he re-enlisted again. And then in 1783, he received the Badge of Honor and received his manumission.
And what did he say about living out the rest of his life in Vermont? Were these happy times for him?
I think the happy times for him was his family, but living in Vermont was a struggle. Just from reading what was written, I mean, there's times that he had to fight for his land and fight for his family. The famine sometimes that was experienced there. But not only that, you know, the neighbors, how they treated him, you know, the indentured servitude that his wife's older children experienced. So it was not an easy time. There was time when he had land and purchased land and had a promise to pay. Someone promised to pay him for the land, and he turned the land over, but never received the monies for it. But it was hard. He was a farmer. But one thing that he always tried to do was to work hard and for his family. They do talk about how he was an honest man, and that one that you could trust, a Christian man, and a man of great valor and loyalty.
And it seems like he was very forthcoming in his memoir about these experiences. I want to bring Professor Jared Ross Hardesty back into the conversation here, and do stay on the line with us, Rhonda, because I want to involve you, too, with this as well. Just listening to what Rhonda is talking about there, Professor Hardesty, does what she's saying about the experience of Jeffrey Brace jive with what your research has shown about slaves who did fight in the Revolutionary War and maybe did try to make a life for themselves in New England that maybe wasn't so easy afterwards?
Absolutely. I mean, he's actually starting his narrative on my bookshelf as Rhonda was talking. And it's absolutely true that these men disproportionately serve, African-American men disproportionately serve, from New England, disproportionately serve in the Continental Army throughout the course of the war, oftentimes seeking their freedom. So they served, and they did, in many cases, receive their freedom. As Rhonda said, Jeffrey Brace had to enlist twice, and it was a bit of a struggle. But many black men in New England following the Revolution could trace their freedom to that service. For example, about 20% of the heads of household in Connecticut in 1790, black heads of household, could trace their freedom to service in the Continental Army. It's a substantial number of black men could do that. But the hope that the Revolution offered of freedom, of opportunity, very quickly kind of gets shut down. And Brace's story is very clear about that. That, you know, he faced discrimination when it came to, he was able to acquire some property, but then he faced both sort of kind of official discrimination, but also this kind of unofficial racism where he was, had kind of swindled out of land. His children were indented. That's a fairly common experience for freed people following the Revolution. There's a fear among New England towns all over the region that free black children will become indigent. They have to be supported by the state, and so they're kind of automatically put into indentured servitude. So yeah, his experience maps quite well the sort of this hope that the Revolution creates, and then the kind of disillusionment and the kind of lost opportunities of the Revolution.
You know, it doesn't sound a whole lot different to me than some of the experiences that African Americans who served in World War II talked about, where, they went and fought Nazism and fascism and then came home to a country that had them, separated in restaurants and in all sorts of other places in public life.
Absolutely. And it's that's actually, interestingly enough, that happens in New England, where they fight in the war, many of them obtain their freedom, or if they don't fight, most of them will obtain their freedom. And, and throughout the course of the War of Independence and in the 1780s and 90s, most African-Americans in New England. And then almost immediately you begin to see the emergence of segregation, for example. So most public schools in New England are segregated by the early 19th century.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Jim on the line with us from Norwich. Hi, Jim. You're on Vermont Edition.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I love history. I just want to make a couple of quick points and then a question.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you guys talked about enslaving the American Indians. And American Indians, were slave owners themselves. The Cherokee, notably. But even up here in the Northeast, they were slave owners. They owned other slaves, and when they could capture whites, they enslaved them as well. And the second point, the question I'm going to ask is there a history of things bringing over slaves from other European countries when they came over?
From other European countries, if I have your question right, Jim. And Professor Hardesty, would you like to tackle that one?
So for the first point, you know, the indigenous people in New England, they held captives, not slaves. Most of the time were captives who the objective was to kind of over time integrate them into their society. The idea was that, especially in the face of demographic collapse following the encounter with Europeans and European disease, one of the objectives of indigenous warfare was captivity, to capture people, to kind of incorporate them into their community. So it's a very different sort of slavery, even very different from, say, the Cherokee, who later come to own actually African Americans and plant the cotton plantations and things like that. So the sort of slavery, quote unquote, I'd call it captivity, that you see in New England is very different. And as to the question about Europeans, they do not enslave other Europeans. If a European is held in bondage of any sort, it's indentured servitude, which is a kind of a limited time. It's about 4 to 7 years, depending on the contract, and they work. And so the difference that I describe is, while on the one hand, the working conditions of indentured servants might be very similar to that of enslaved people, especially in a place like Boston, they're oftentimes doing the same work. There's a huge difference in terms of the nature of ownership. So in indentured servitude, the master, the owner, owns somebody's time. So they own their time for 4 to 7 years. In slavery, which only applies to people of color, so of indigenous or of African descent in New England, they own the body. And they own generations of people. And so that's then they can kind of do with the body as they see fit. And so that's the big difference there. So you don't see the sort of any sort of European enslavement, but you do see indentured servitude. It's fairly prevalent at different times throughout New England's history.
And that's the voice of Jared Ross Hardesty, and he is the author of the book Black Lives, Native Lands, White Worlds, A History of Slavery in New England. We're also joined on the line listening into this conversation by Rhonda Brace, who found out not too long ago that she is the descendant of a slave who fought in the Revolutionary War, was brought to New England, and eventually lived out the rest of his life in Vermont. We have this question from Phil from Burlington. He writes, "Thanks for this interesting topic on a piece of Vermont history that I knew very little about." And he asks, "Is there any evidence of organized rebellion by people who were enslaved in Vermont?" And Professor Hardesty, I'll ask you that question.
Not in Vermont that I know of. Oftentimes it's very hard to get it to the kind of interior lives of enslaved people and what they talk about in their off time and things like that. There are a couple examples of kind of organized slave rebellions in New England, though. There's one in Boston in 1723, which seemed to be kind of an arson conspiracy, where an enslaved man named Diego and a few associates try to burn Boston down at various points throughout the spring of 1723. Diego's eventually arrested and executed. Interestingly enough, his associates are not. They're arrested, but ultimately acquitted for lack of evidence, which shows a serious judicial restraint you often don't see in slave society. So even in New York, city where there's a huge slave conspiracy in 1741, dozens of people were actually executed in the course of that. So it's a little bit different. Then there's also two rumored conspiracies in the 18th century as well, around the time of the Revolution, involving British soldiers, both during the occupation in 1768 of Boston, and then again in 1774 with General Gage. But there's very little evidence that those were real, and it seems to be the kind of imagination of the white colonists, kind of projecting their own anxieties and fears onto the political landscape.
Okay, we've got Barb on the line from Plainfield. Barb, hi, you're on Vermont Edition. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm just thrilled to hear this program, and I wanted to let the guests and also your listeners know I'm part of a group called that's on slavery and genealogy, and we're a group mostly descendants of slaveholders and occasionally descended from enslaved peoples. And we meet as a support group once a month in downtown Montpelier at the North Branch Cafe on 41 State Street. And our next meetup, which is open to anybody who's interested to come in, our next meetup is next week, the 26th of February at 4:45. So wonderful work that you're doing, and I'm thrilled to be VPR's covering this issue.
Barb, thank you. I want you to hang on the line for just a second here because I'm finding this quite amazing. You're saying that your group meets as a kind of support group because some of your ancestry you can trace back to slaveholders. Now, you know, we have Rhonda Brace on the line with us. Rhonda, if you're still with us here, you know, how do you feel about hearing about something like that, that Barb and her friends are doing in Plainfield? How does that make you feel as a descendant of a slave yourself?
Well, I think that's fascinating. I had the opportunity to actually visit the homestead of the slaveholders who held Jeffrey Brace in Connecticut, in Woodbury, Connecticut, back in 2014. I think it was like 2013, 2014, maybe a little earlier than that. But it's still the family home and the family residence that some of the family still reside in. And my parents and I had the opportunity to go to Woodbury, Connecticut, and actually meet one of the descendants who whose name is Benjamin Stiles. Hmm. And he even gave us the opportunity, or my dad and I, the opportunity. We went down to where the slave quarters would have been, where Jeffrey Brace would have been during that time period he was enslaved in Connecticut. However, I think it's great that, you know, slaveholders are coming to the table and not afraid to share the history of their former slaveholders. There's another organization, I'm going to probably get the name wrong, but come into the table that also focuses on descendants of slaveholders with descendants of former slaves. And I had a brief encounter with them a few years ago. But I think it's fascinating because I think all history is everybody's history. I think we need to embrace and learn about one another. And I don't think that we should shy away from anything. That gives us a broader sense of who we are and where we come from.
Barb, it sounds like what Rhonda is saying here is jibes with what you've heard as well.
Absolutely. We, in fact, a friend and I who started the group were inspired by the Coming to the Table group. We've read their material, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's just trying to cope with the realization that our ancestors were part of this terrible period And I'm very, very interested in knowing more about the situation in New England, too. So thank you, Rhonda, and thanks to all of you.
Well, thank you. It sounds like your dog agrees with you, too, as well, Barb, from the Plainfield. Thank you very much for the call. We have this comment from Barbara, who writes, "We learned about slaves only as victims, which they were, but we were never taught about their centrality as builders of the country, how foundational their blood, sweat, and tears were to where we are now as one of the richest countries in the world." Professor Hardesty, what about Barbara's comment there? You know, yes, victims, of course, but they built, slaves built so much of this country. Is that true for New England, too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is, you know, one of the more shocking parts. I've been doing this research for about a decade. My first book looked at just Boston, and this book, you know, kind of looks at New England as a whole. And one of the more shocking kind of parts of doing the research was just how often slavery appears in the records generally. But kind of a real moment for me was I was reading through the town records of Boston. And this is not so much the selectmen's accounts and or the selectmen's records and the, you know, vital records and things like that. But I was looking through the manuscript records or how the Boston Public Library of the town's actual accounts of the business the town's doing in the 17th and 18th century. You know, it's paying to build things. It's paying to, you know, have bridges repaired, paying for the schoolhouse. And just the ubiquity of enslaved labor, of enslaved people building, physically building the town of Boston, working on roads, bridges, buildings, digging wells, digging ditches, digging aqueducts. All of that sort of work was done by enslaved people, building forts in the harbor. And so just that kind of ever presence. And so Barbara's question is really an excellent one. Is that it's not only, you know, enslaved people were certainly victims, but they also are central to building through exploitation, building the place we live in now.
Okay, we've got to go to a break in a moment, but before we do, I want to ask Rhonda Brace one more thing. And Rhonda, I'm wondering if you have a family of your own. When you discovered this about your descendant, that you were related to Jeffrey Brace, that he was a slave, et cetera, how did you discuss it with them? Is it something that you know, still bring up and want to encourage among having your own family know about their roots?
Yes. One of the things that I did was to organize one or two bus trips to Vermont, St. Albans, Vermont. And there is there are descendants of Jeffrey Brace still in Vermont as well, and had the opportunity to meet with Jim Brace. And I thought it was important for us here in the Springfield area to take a trip to see where we come from as far as St. Albans. And so I share that information. We've had, when the book originally first came out, we had a book signing event with Kari Winters, who currently is the interim director of the executive director of the University of Buffalo Humanities Institute. And she was basically the driving force for us being even able to know our history. So I try very often, as much as I can, to share with my family. And then also I'm now a part of a group called Inspired by Courage, and we're all descendants of slave narratives and one descendant of Dred Scott. And next week we'll be in the Washington State area at the Northwest African American Museum. So I think it's very important that not I only continue to share it with my family, but also to a broader audience.
Well, Rhonda, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and we've been talking today about the history of slavery in Vermont and throughout New England. We've been speaking with Rhonda Brace, a descendant of Jeffrey Brace, who was born in West Africa, enslaved as a teenager, eventually spent the remainder of his life in Vermont, and Jared Ross Hardesty, associate professor of history at Western Washington University, author of Black Lives, Native Lands, White Worlds, A History of Slavery in New England. Professor Hardesty, we only have a few minutes left, and I'm sorry about that. There is still so much to talk about here. But one of the things I do want to talk about is this question. It can be very divisive when talking about these issues now. And this is the question of reparations. In the late 1980s, then President Reagan approved reparation payments to the relatives of Japanese Americans who were displaced from their homes, forcibly interred in camps in California. That didn't draw a whole lot of controversy at the time, nor is it now. But when reparations for the descendants of slaves are mentioned, the reaction from many white people especially can be dismissive at best. What is your feeling when it comes to this question of reparations?
I'm not exactly equipped to answer the political question side of it. I think there's been a number of models that have come out, say like that of Ta-Nehisi Coates and things like that, that advocates a sort of more equitable and sort of effective way of a form of reparations. Where I come down on the issue of reparations is I think we need to think about it as a bigger than just, I think when we think about reparations, I guess is how I'll phrase this, is we think about it as kind of handing a check to the descendants of enslaved people, giving them money, cash assistance, things like that, where I think we need a broader definition of what reparations are and what they can be, what that means. And it's not just about, compensating the descendants of enslaved people. I think it's also about education. I think it's about ensuring that future generations, the current generation, future generations, have access to this information, have a sort of, a set of facts, a kind of starting point for these conversations. And so to acknowledge this past in its kind of holistically and in its sort of fullest. And so that means, discussing slavery in New England or really anywhere across the United States, because it's so central to, the United States and its current economic and political power globally. It built the nation, as we just talked about, to ensure that students K through 12 and in universities are learning about the history of slavery, to ensure that, our public museums and public history sites have this information on display and can discuss, their connections to slavery, is to ensure that information is out there, and to educate. And so when I think about reparations, I don't think about this question of just about being, cash assistance or whatever that will look like, the kind of economic side of it. There's also an educational component.
You're right that one of the effects of what you call a failed promise to deliver on emancipation's promise of freedom, equality, civil rights, in New England is that there was this great diaspora, this exodus of black people from New England. Briefly, where did these folks go? And does it explain to some extent why Vermont is still to this day one of the whitest states in the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's they leave New England, and it's a variety. There's kind of a variety of processes. Part of it is about their kind of segregation and marginalization in New England society. So they just kind of pack up and leave. Many of them, of course, were veterans, so they received land in Ohio and other parts of the Northwest. What became the Northwest Territory, but also many of them settle in New York. But others are, of course, are sold out. They're kidnapped or they're still technically enslaved and they're sold out, so especially to Atlantic Canada. But yeah, it does help to explain the relatively low black populations in certain parts of New England to this day.
We've been speaking with Jared Ross Hardesty, Associate Professor of History at Western Washington University and the author of Black Lives, Native Lands, White Worlds, A History of Slavery in New England. Professor Hardesty, thank you so much for the time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.